Okay, so I guess we'll get started. And as Monty Python quipped, now for something completely different. So today I'm going to talk to you about Halo Archaea. I'll tell you what they are, and I'll talk about recombination outcomes and the mechanisms. And my overall interest, really, is I've said a couple times in introductions, is that I'm interested in speciation. And it's been a long road that I've taken, and so here I am going to try to show you all the, not everything, but I'm going to throw a lot of mud up on the barn wall and see what sticks. Okay, so basically, sexual and asexual reproduction seems to be the only two models that we use to test how variation is accumulated and distributed amongst individuals and populations and species, right? And how barriers to homogenizing forces permit genetic divergence to occur. And in reality, I mean, we kind of all sort of know this intuitively, but if you, and the pop gen people here probably know this better than I do, but I know that there's a diverse crowd, so I just thought I'd go over this a little bit. And so the real advantage to sexual reproduction over asexual reproduction comes to the ability to fix advantageous traits in a population. And so here we have three advantageous traits, B, A, and C, and they're all invented at the same time in different organisms. And, well, just saying, this is a very old idea from 65. And the idea here is that the three different individual organisms that these traits are invented in compete in a head-to-head competition because there's no recombination, and one of them has to win eventually. And so that's what this represents. This is fixation, or the probability of finding that trait in all of the organisms. And so once A complete, the organism that has the A allele, its entire genome will replace the entire population, and B and C have to be reinvented in the background, in the genetic background of A. And so that happens, and so you get B and you get C being invented, and then A and B outcompete A and C, but eventually, given enough time, you'll get all three traits in the same individual, but it has to be built on to the background of the genetics of the previous organisms. Now, the real advantage is in sexual reproduction, you can have these same three alleles or traits born, not alleles, but loci, born in different individuals. And just by simply breeding those two individuals, you can get them in the same genetic background at the same time. And so it quickens the pace of the adaptation of advantageous loci in populations. Okay. Now, of course, this doesn't take into a lot of, this is 1965, so a lot of things like clonal interference and have contributed to our better understanding of populations. But I just want to say that in reality, there's a third model that we don't really think about too much, and this is that prokaryotes reproduce asexually, but they undergo a copious amount of gene exchange. And they do this through three basic mechanisms, although there is a fourth now called gene transfer agents that hasn't made it into the canonical literature. But transformation, which is the ability of an organism to pick up naked DNA out of the environment. There's conjugation, which is usually the transfer of a plasmid from one organism to another, and this transfer is almost exclusively coded on that plasmid. And then there's transduction, which is a virus picking up DNA from one host and transferring it to another host. Now, this is a simple way of thinking about it, I think, and the details are all very complicated, and I'm not going to talk about them too much, at least not right now.
Can you say a word about how transformation actually gets the DNA into the cell?
I will later.
Okay.
But But to suffice to say, transformation, what I almost always argue is that these are selfish elements. They're thinking about their own reproduction only, and that transformation is actually a very complex system encoded by the host for bringing DNA in. And I'll talk much more about that later on, okay? But the outcome of all of this lateral gene transfer or gene flow is that it really muddies our understanding of how evolution, well, not how evolution occurred, but when you look back, it's very difficult to understand how organisms are actually related to each other. And it really challenges our concept of a common ancestor, because we can only go back so far before we come to this mess, and we don't really know how organisms are related to each other. Okay. Now there's good reasons for believing that this is the case. Okay, and again, this is not the topic of my talk, but just some introduction. Okay. But what I'd like to get at in my talk is probably an overambitious list of questions that I hope to address to some extent today. And so, what is the rate of recombination? Right? How does that affect the distribution of alleles in a population? Is there transfer between species? How does this transfer affect our concept of what species are? I should have a close quote there. How does divergence and speciation occur? What are the barriers to gene flow, and what are the mechanisms of gene flow? And so, in order to avoid being too broad in my talk, I'm only going to talk about the Haloarchaea, and specifically, I'm really only going to be talking about a genus or two within these organisms and within this class of organisms, and these are the organisms that I study. Now, in the canonical Carl Woesian tree of life based on the 16S, here's where the Haloarchaea live. And they're all aerobic organisms, they're all heterotrophic organisms, and they're all obligate hypersaline adapted, right? You put them in water and they will die, right? Fresh water, even marine water, they will die, okay? So this environment is extremely, it's an extreme environment. It's extremely extreme. This is what it looks like when you're the salinity, once it gets to be about 15%, the water turns red, and these are the organisms that I study. They live in 35% salt, which is basically the saturation level of salt in water. This has enormous impacts on the ability to live. There's very low water activity. I mean, the molecules of water are just spread apart by the ions. There's very low solubility of gases, very low diffusion rates, high temperatures. These are almost always in environments of, San Diego or deserts or, you can see the cells here. So they live at very high cell densities, 10 to the 9th cells per milliliter. And one of the crazy things is there's very little primary production, especially at the higher salinities. There are some algae that can grow in these situations, but they don't do very well above 25% or so. And so they're not really producing anything. And
so, what's the turnover, the 10 to the 9th? Per mil,
that would have to be done on a species by species case, and it's very difficult to measure. There are a couple of measurements that I know about. One was 5 days, and one was 6 months. So. My understanding is that it's really dependent on how frequently it rains, which may not be very often. So just to throw this out there, I don't want to talk about it at all. But some people claim that in salt crystals that are hundreds of millions of years old, they can grow these organisms out of the inclusion bodies. So, you know, I'm not sure, but they must have a very slow reproductive reproduction in those cases.
Sorry, primary production refers to photosynthesis?
Well, yeah, so, or just the fixation of carbon dioxide in, whether it's photosynthesis or...
Whatever.
And so when it rains?
It pours.
Salt concentration goes down, and then the primary producers go to work, and then these things go to work, and then...
Presumably.
Is that the way it's thought?
Presumably. So literally, I mean, they are embalmed in their environment, in a sense. So they have a lot of special adaptive characteristics. They can actually live inside of salt crystals. Salt, you know, or the absence of water, well, I can't really say that there's no water in there, because there's going to be water inside the crystals as the crystals form. But, you know, E. coli is not going to do this, that's for sure. And of course, we use salt for millennia in order to preserve our food, and salt was the oil of the ancient world. To do this, the Haloarchaea have a very unique proteome. And so here is a graph of the isoelectric point of all of the proteins in the proteome of the Haloarchaea, or several Haloarchaea. And so they're very shifted to the left. The PI of their proteins is extremely acidic, okay? Whereas almost all of life, I mean, this is you can take this to the bank. They have this bimodal distribution of isoelectric points, and this refers to the, well, and I never remember which is which, but one of these peaks is for membrane-bound proteins, and one, the other is for the cytosolic proteins. But in order for these proteins to remain soluble and work in this highly salt environment, I forgot to mention, the way there are basically two strategies for dealing with salt, and one is to pump salt out, right? And then you have to have some sort of osmolyte that helps balance the osmotic pressure inside the cell, right? But these organisms do something very different. Their internal salinity is equal to that of the environment, right? And so that's why they do this. Okay. Now this is actually a graph of a paper that we published on the genome of Salinibacter rubra, which is not a Haloarchaean, but has adapted the strategy of the Haloarchaea, and it's in this blue line. And it's very related to things that live in our guts, for instance. And so you can kind of see that it has a little hump here of remaining of this, and that it hasn't quite reached the same peak, and it's slightly shifted to the right, and so it's undergoing a genomic adaptation to its acidic proteome. Okay.
As you said, the water molecules are very far apart at these salt concentrations, and so in the Haloarchaea, that's true inside.
Presumably.
So how does it do all the things?
It's a mystery, I think. I mean, yeah. So some of the other adaptations that it has, bacteriodopsins, which are light-driven pumps that they use. We have rhodopsins in our eyes, if you'll remember. But the Haloarchaea use it for generating a proton gradient, so they can make ATP for free. So it pumps protons to the outside of the membrane, and then they come back in through an ATPase. But they have several different kinds of rhodopsins. They have chloride pump rhodopsins. They also have rhodopsins that allow them to move towards useful and away from harmful lights. They also have gas vesicles, which allow them to float up and down in the water column, presumably mostly up, because, well, there's almost no oxygen in this water, and they are obligate aerobes. And to make rhodopsins, for sure, they need to have oxygen. They also tend to be flat. Not all of them are flat, but many of them are flat, and this increases their surface-to-volume ratio, which helps them to get over this lack of water problem. So these are their major adaptations, and they're really, I don't know, some advantages. They're very difficult to kill in the laboratory, you know. But part of that is that they have very slow growth rates. So I can leave them on a petri dish for a year and come back and grab a colony and start again.
Sir, I think I'm confused. So they don't really divide, right? You said the concentration doesn't really change
them like
the
dilute. Well, what they do in nature, I mean, we don't really know, but certainly if you put them into a sterile environment at high concentration of salt, they will grow, they will reproduce, right? But in nature, I guess there gets to be a point where they're so crowded together and there's no nutrients left, and rather than die like you might expect E. coli or something like that, they just persist at these very high densities.
And they aggregate?
They probably do. I mean, this is very syrupy, right? I mean, the density of the water is very thick.
And so they can get ATP through this rhodopsin thing.
Right, so they pump the protons using light energy.
Glucose or some sort of nutrient, how do they do that if they don't have the, I guess they don't have the Krebs?
So primary, there's a Krebs cycle, but the primary production is almost non-existent. So, well, one of the things that they do is they're very good at eating each other. Mm-hmm. They're very good at cannibalizing everything.
Which might be a reason why they don't die.
Well, they're also, I mean, these are one of the few organisms that have ever survived exposure to space. So they've been on the space shuttle and exposed to gamma radiation and so on and so forth. And they're just highly resistant to desiccation, highly resistant to UV radiation, gamma radiation, all kinds of things. So, I mean, they're rather remarkable organisms.
Do any of their relatives live in the Dead Sea?
Yep, absolutely.
Absolutely. So when you say they reach these high densities and persist, what could be going on is turnover still.
I mean, yeah. I mean, the
cannibalism implies that, for one.
Yeah, I mean, you would, or at least I would assume, at least the ecologist in me would assume, that once it reaches a certain density, which is that would be the carrying capacity of the environment, then you have to have a death before you can have a birth, and so, it's very slow. It's very slow.
What's known about the cell wall? Is there some analog of gram-positive and gram-negative?
Well, I mean, it stains. This is an archaean, so it doesn't have peptidoglycan. It has it's called an S layer, and this is just because I searched. I know that there are some photographs of these S layers, and I really wanted to show it to you, but it's glycoproteins and assorted other things, and each organism basically kind of has its own set of monomers that it constructs but it does have a cell wall of sorts, yeah.
And a lipid bilayer, two lipid bilayers?
Not two lipid bilayers, right, yeah. And often, so the archaea don't use ester-linked lipids. Canonically, they use ether-linked lipids, and they can either go completely through the membrane, or it can be a bilayer. So it could be a monolayer, could be a bilayer. So there's quite a lot of physiological differences between what we think about in bacteria but among archaea, there's a lot of differences, a lot of variation. So,
sorry, one last glucose question. So in the lab, how do they get glucose? I mean, say they can't eat each other, what else could they do?
You know, I don't even, I'm not even sure if, the, if they will eat.
Coli will eat each other. If you put seal in a test tube, they'll eat each other and go on and on and on and on for years. You just sealed in a test tube.
But, you know, we add carbon substrates. To grow them initially out of the environment, I used yeast extract. But in the laboratory, we typically grow them on acetate. But they're extremely rich in their diversity and ability to utilize carbon substrates. I mean, they'll ferment amino acids and they do have some anaerobic capabilities. So even though they're aerobic, they use oxygen as their terminal electron acceptor during respiration. They do have other strategies for coping with these extreme environments. So just to move on, unless there's any, I mean, they're amazing organisms. for millennia, humans have been evaporating salt, seawater, making sea salt. And this is sort of the way they do it. This is a salt tern in Spain that I collected from. And basically, here's the Mediterranean Sea. They pump the salt water or the seawater into these big ponds in the back, and they accumulate. They evaporate, and they start to accumulate salt. And once that starts to happen, you see these beautiful cyanobacterial blooms. And then, so I mean, every single color that you see is really a difference in community structure. And as the water evaporates, they can move them into these smaller ponds, and concentrate the salts. And then once they get up into these orange, these are carotenoids of the haloarchaea. And so it's sort of like that game that, I don't know, when we used to do road trips back in the 70s, there was this little tile game that you had to move the tiles around.
Sliding square game.
What's that called?
Sliding square game?
Yeah.
Tiles in one
and you had to produce a picture. Well, this is kind of like that. So, here they're going to collect the salt, right? And so they got to keep moving. It's like an enormous chemostat, in a sense. So, and it takes maybe about a year, I think, depending on how hot it is and how much it rains. And then, of course, they collect the salt here. And
their halobacteria in the collected salt?
Well, presumably, yeah, presumably. I mean, some of the first descriptions of the haloarchaea came from salted cod. So if you read through your old Berge's manuals, you'll find very interesting discussions about codfish and even maybe Egyptian mummies sort of get rotted away a little bit by these things.
So are we ingesting them now?
We probably are, but they would die immediately after they enter. Touch your tongue, for instance, because it's not salty enough, right? And because their internal salt concentration is equal, they'll osmotically explode, which would be the opposite of E. coli landing on salt, wouldn't they? Would shrivel, right? So what I did was I sampled a couple ponds from the same site. And these are roads, you can drive on these roads here. This is the city of Santa Pola. And so I sampled two different ponds of different salinities, 36 and 22%. And then while I was there, so at the same exact time, a woman from Algeria brought a sample from a natural lake in Algeria that was 250 kilometers away, but also the same salinity. So this gave me a very nice opportunity to compare the effects of salinity and geographic distance on community composition. So this was my you know, this is the beginning of my postdoc, and when I was a graduate student, I was very much enamored with biogeography. And so, and my thinking back then was that geography probably plays a much more important role in speciation than ecological adaptation, and I wanted to address some of this. And I'll talk a little bit about it, but I think it became the secondary or an unimportant aspect eventually. So I say isolated. Actually, I only examined 153. I isolated hundreds and hundreds. But getting sequence data from five different loci, you know, one, it becomes very, very expensive, and two, very time consuming. And so I just stopped at 153. But I sequenced, so we sequenced the 16S RNA gene, ATPB, which is an ATPase subunit, elongation factor 2, RAD-A, which is REC-A homolog in archaea, and I worked bacteriodopsin. And everybody always asks, why did you choose those genes? And I started this back in 2002, and there weren't really any genomes available, and these were really the only genes that anybody had sequenced that I could build some sort of primers that would amplify genes from all kinds of organisms. And I mean, I think that, I think I got lucky in many ways that these were the genes that I worked on. So if you take all of those genes and you concatenate them together, and all that means is you just take them and you join them end to end and you make a phylogeny out of them as if they're the same gene, right? Or, you know, representing the entire organism. This is rejecting any notions of recombination and so on and so forth. But a lot of thought has gone into doing this, and the people who believe in these sorts of things suggest that it really does sort of average out all of the recombination and allows you to build a rather robust phylogeny. And so this is the phylogeny of the 153 strains that we got. Now, these are all, by definition, by 16S definition, these are all Halorubrum, so they're all the same genus, okay? And the colors refer to the sample sites that I got them from. And then if there's, for instance, more than one color at the same place, that means I found at least two representatives of that same genotype. They're identical at the five loci, right? But it doesn't really, so basically though, we didn't find any clonality. I mean, this was our most highly represented strain or sequence type, we call them, and it occurred 12 times, and it occurred in all three of these sample sites. So, you know, right away I can sort of reject barriers to dispersal. You know, here's one genotype found in all three situations, and we can probably reject adaptation to salinity as well. Because again, we're found, the same genotype is found in all three sample sites. But there are biases to cultivation, and so I don't really look at this data as really being too informative on geography or adaptation, but it does give us some hints of what may be. And it seems that phylogroup A, you know, which is just comprised of these sequence types, seems much more diverse than for, you know, in terms of its ability to migrate or to adapt to different salinities than, for instance, phylogroup B, which seems to be mostly comprised of sample 36% salinity. You have a question?
So these are 10 sort of phylogroup A is of order 1%, a fraction of a percent sequence difference, is that?
We'll go to that in a second, but I just want to It's about a quarter of a percent, actually.
Can you tell us about the sampling process? So when you have 10 strains from the same pond, are they from one water sample or from 10 water samples?
They're all from the same water sample.
Okay.
And actually, all of these, you know, I mean, I can't really remember now, but I probably did maybe 10 plates from each sample, and on each plate, I probably put about 50 microliters on each plate.
So I would expect more quality in that case. You have, I would imagine, there's not a lot of mixing, and I don't know. Normally, this place
does
not a lot of waves. I don't know
about it. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's pretty thick stuff. So, but there is wind dispersal. I mean, there were I called them tumbleweeds. But like, if you go down on the beach here and you see you'll get these foam things as the tide comes in. Well, there are these things, but they're enormous and they're blowing over the waters just like tumbleweeds do. So there are ways of getting dispersal occurring, and they're not very, you know, they're probably only about this deep, right? So, you know, there are opportunities for getting wind mixes and other potential.
What is the annual rainfall at the Spanish Lake?
I don't know, millimeters. it's a microclimate. Unique in this to this particular region, and there I don't know, while I was there in the rainy season, you know, it probably rained a few drops here and there. Yeah. Jeff.
Yeah, so if you were to use the word species,
I'll get to that in a sec. Yeah.
And some members of the audience would ask, why would you want to use the word species?
Huh?
What does species mean?
Yeah. Well, I hope to answer a bunch of questions, but these are all good questions, and it's obvious that, you know, the way I'm presenting this data, well, these are the sorts of things that I'm going to be thinking about and presenting. So, you know, it was clear, right, and as it was pointed out, that they're very closely related to each other, and that they form these very nice, well-supported bootstrap clusters, and we know that phylogroup C is more closely related to phylogroup B, and phylogroup A is the sister group to this, and then we've got all of these strains that are obviously outside those clusters, and we could probably make some very informed understanding about how the evolution of these organisms occurred. Okay. One of the things is that they have, so in addition to that, they form these very discrete clusters, right, suggesting that they could be species. If you compare the amount of diversity within and between these different clusters, phylogroup A is in a pairwise scenario, they're about 0.25% diverged, and phylogroup B is about 0.5% diverged, and phylogroup C is about 1% diverged. I forgot to tell you that phylogroup C is only found in Algeria. And I'll try to remember to come back to this in a second or later on in the talk, but essentially phylogroup C, for all intents and purposes for this data, looks like it might be endemic to Algeria. So all three of the phylogroups are found in Algeria, but in Spain only phylogroups A and B are found in Spain. Right? Okay. So, and then all of the diversity in those clusters that I showed, these are all synonymous substitutions. There are no amino acid substitutions within clusters. Between clusters, yes, but within clusters, only neutral substitutions. And so if you compare this to the average species diversity of synonymous sites, invertebrates, and plants, our diversity here is, well, it seems reasonable and canonical. Perhaps we can call these things species. Okay, I mean, building up a case, let's examine, test these ideas. Okay, question?
Are those values only for the genes that you sampled in the hollow archaea?
Of course. I mean, I could make up other values if you'd like. So, I mean, and then, you know, there's no other data set like this, too. I mean,
Or is it about the same with those five intervals? Because you can expect slower evolution for ribosomal and maybe somewhat faster.
Yeah, so there are differences, and I'll talk a little bit about that, too. I mean, in the 16S, I can't remember, but there's for this whole cluster, I don't think they're more than 1% diverged. Okay. Yes, Boris?
Phyla group C,
yeah,
where you have 1% intracluster divergence, it's still only synonymous?
Yep.
But these are very highly conserved genes. But is there a lot of magnesium also in these, and other, so, and everything inside the cell is also then?
I mean, they're particular about which ions they do collect.
Okay, so the sodium they just let go, so the internal concentration is the same, but some of the other ions they're.
So the overall salinity is equal. They substitute potassium for sodium, I think. So, one of the other things, all right, so we can think about species in terms of gene flow. So, in a biological species concept, one would expect that species should be randomly, or individuals should be randomly mating within the populations, and that there should be really no mating between populations. And so, if we just take a very coarse measurement using the index of association, which just measures how randomly associated or not alleles are at different loci in the population, it turns out that each of the phyla groups is actually in equilibrium. And this means that within those phyla groups, the alleles at different loci are randomly associated with each other, just like we all look different from each other because of recombination and assortment of alleles at loci in populations. You know, it's the same exact outcome.
Okay. This 0.25% say sequence divergence though within phylogroup A means you have roughly one polymorphism per locus, is that about right?
So there's about 2,500 positions that are analyzed, but
total across the five.
Yeah.
So 0.25% is 1.5%.
Okay.
Per.
I didn't actually do that calculation, but you can do that calculation if you
want. But the sequence is done from, I mean, it's culturing individuals, and then the sequence is done from the grown population, so you know which genes are from the same organisms.
Yes. Yes.
And what about polymorphism within populations?
So, it's in a couple more slides.
So is IA like linkage equilibrium, that's what you're telling us?
Yeah.
Within population.
Within population. So the alleles at different loci within the phyla groups are randomly associated. So it's as if they are randomly mating with each other, just like obligate sexual populations.
But, I mean, with the numbers of these differences, you could get this random mating every 100 years or something like that, right? Mating every 100 years would be enough.
Yeah, I don't know when it happened.
No, I mean, the question is if you have like
how much mating do you need to get this?
If you have only like one polymorphism, one site that's polymorphic per locus, I mean, you need very little mating to make it look random, right?
Well, I can tell you that I don't know. I mean, usually you don't. This, I would say that this is a pretty difficult thing to come by, right? They're random. I mean, random. right? There's no, this is including all of the, you know, so I didn't take out anything, right? That's you know, so even with this little bit of clonality you see here and here, really no effect, right? So again, this is the expected outcome for randomly mating obligate sexually reproducing species. Okay? And this is a very just a very coarse measurement, and yet we still find it.
How is the position on a chromosome? It's not sequenced yet. Why
haven't you sequenced all these? I mean,
well, it's cheap, you think?
Cheap.
No, it's not really cheap. I mean, it doesn't cost $1 million per genome anymore, but it's not cheap, I assure you. A little bit. I mean, anyway, if you want to donate to the cause, I'd be more than happy to sequence them. But, you know,
resequencing, you can give $100 a genome.
Yeah, you would think. Yeah, it's so easy.
But is it just resequencing, or is it, I mean, is there a base
genome sequence?
No, I don't think so.
This is the standard, basically, how far are these from the standard laboratory strains for
what do you mean, standard laboratory strains?
One of these is, the one related to these is a model organism in the lab, not one of these.
Yeah. I mean, the organism we study that we have genetics for, Halopharynx, is, well, I would say it's a related genus, but it's divergent quite a bit.
But there is a question. I mean, if you want to do it well enough to be able to reconstruct the whole genome and everything is harder, but to get a much more idea of what's there, is there a difference?
I'm not saying that I'm not interested in doing that. I'm just saying that it's not as simple and cheap as people think.
We suspend discussion for maybe 15 minutes, and because I have a feeling that the only sort of 5 minutes into your talk.
No, I'm on slide 13.
Out of.
I don't know. Okay, so we can measure the relative rates of recombination to mutation. And it turns out, without going into the details, and we can talk about details if you want, but it's really a binning process. And the per allele is about 2 to 1. So 2 times every allele is changed by recombination twice as frequently as it is by a mutation, and the per nucleotide is 9 times higher. Okay, now some people say, okay, well, these are asexually reproducing organisms, and so the recombination rate necessarily is very low because it's not obligatory to reproduce, and so, you know, what does recombination mean? So I don't know if not everybody was here for Rachel's talk, but she showed this animation GIF in which populations were being homogenized by rates of recombination, and it turns out that these rates of recombination and mutation are basically the same results that computer simulation used to demonstrate homogenization of populations. And so that's what I'm trying to say here, and that if you compare the relative rates of recombination to mutation in humans and Drosophila and Arabidopsis and pine trees, this relative rate is, well, somewhere between 2.5 and 30 times higher than obligate sexual organisms that are well studied. Okay.
How is this estimated? It's 2 to 1.
We can talk about that. We're
the sequence, so
No. We identify the alleles, and then we find things that are identical across 4 alleles, and we look at the 5th allele, and we look to see how many differences it has, right? So, but we can talk more. We're office mates. Okay, so getting to a little bit about polymorphism in each of the different populations. within, and remember, all of these polymorphisms, again, are neutral polymorphisms within each of the groups. So, so for instance, ATPB has 19 neutral polymorphisms within phyla group A, okay? And 11 for red A, and 3 for EF2, and 2 for rhodopsin. So in fact, you know, we get to average, you know, substitutions per allele or per locus. I mean, for instance, there's 19 in ATPB and 2 in rhodopsin. Now, I don't know if that strikes you as being odd, but to me it did. And I was thinking and thinking and thinking about this for a long time. Why is it that an extremely conserved gene, which is found in all organisms, just about, is used as a marker for looking at phylogeny across all of the domains of life? Why is it that this gene has 19 neutral mutations, where rhodopsin genes, which are extremely diverse even within the haloarchaea, right, only has 2 neutral mutations? And these 2 neutral mutations are actually only found in 2 organisms. So there's 1 polymorphism in 2 different organisms. Okay? And 90% of the individuals have the same allele. Okay? And so this is, in my opinion, a very strange outcome.
You check the correlation with expression levels, because the rhodopsin has presumably expressed at a very high level, and there.
Well, I would think that there should be basically a one-to-one correlation between ATP and rhodopsins, for instance. I mean, but that's a good question.
ATPs. I mean, there are so many ATPases which are expressed. So this one is expressed constitutively at high.
I really don't have this exact information to tell you that for certain deletes, for certainty.
What is bizarre is that why they're reversed in C, yeah. Why in C, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They're roughly equal, why didn't they?
Yeah. So, I think that there is an explanation for this. And I mean, you know, you're right, there could be, based on expression levels, that codon biases could occur. One of the things that I didn't mention is that these organisms are they're about 70% GC. And almost all of this occurs in the third codon position. So these two are actually A and T mutations. So they're not fixed in the population by any stretch of the imagination. Whereas these are all G and C polymorphisms.
And by the way, this correlation with expression level is for missense mutations, not for silent mutations.
Well, there is for codon, so what happens is organisms tend to optimize codon usage in their genomes, and highly expressed organisms will have codons that reflect the transfer RNAs that they have available, and so, or the number of transfer RNAs. And so there could be some selective pressure at the third codon position not to change based on the frequency in which that gene is expressed. But I don't think that that is the reason here. What I think we have to do is we have to invoke a sexual model explanation that those rhodopsins that are nearly 100% identical and in 100% of the organisms, right, they recently underwent a selective sweep in the population, okay? So you can imagine, for instance, here's genome H, these are 5 different loci and each of the different alleles in the population. And this particular allele at locus 3 got an adaptive mutation which conferred an advantage. Because these organisms are highly recombinogenic, they're not linked to each other, right? These loci, they're not asexually, they're asexual. I don't know how to say it exactly. But there's a lot of recombination going on, and these loci are not necessarily linked to each other. recombination occurs. So you can imagine you get one organism, it divides, you've got two copies that are identical. And then you can have recombination of, say, this allele from this organism into the genetic background, right? And so you're starting to diversify yourself. And also, the rhodopsin itself could, of course, be recombined into a different genetic background, which immediately unlinks it, right? And you do this enough, and eventually you can have an identical allele at one locus while maintaining the diversity of all of the other alleles in the loci in the population.
What are the frequencies of these polymorphisms?
Here's the number of polymorphisms per, right? And so there's about 50 organisms per cluster, and they're,
you have two sites that are polymorphic in this phylum group A, in this
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
So you also know how many individuals have one or the other.
This, I do, and so it's only these polymorphisms are only in two organisms, right? So everybody else, 90% of the organisms have the same allele. And again, I said that those polymorphisms is an A and a T in the third codon position, which in that position is like 90% GC, right? So these are not fixed, they're probably an actual mutation, not a fixation.
Whereas if you look at the other genes, the polymorphisms presumably are higher frequencies, is that right?
Yes, exactly. And so these are all distributed fairly well throughout the, I think probably, if I remember correctly, I certainly looked at that data and it's been a long time, but the most dominant allele for any of these is less than 50% of the population.
Did you understand the recombination is caused possibly by cannibalism, or
we'll talk if I
we'll
if,
get there
maybe
if we like.
Okay, so just to recap what I've talked about, it seems that the gene flow in prokaryotes, and I just want to say that even though, you know, these are odd organisms, right, more and more people are doing these sorts of experiments, and they're finding similar results as I find, right? I mean, this is not an oddball sort of thing. This is probably standard in microorganisms, and you know, the only reason why I'm able to make a lot of conclusions about this is because I looked at a lot of different organisms, a lot of different individual cultures. Right, and this is what, you know, by having populations to look at, and by having three different closely related populations to look at, I mean, we are able to make really nice observations. Okay, so gene flow in prokaryotes, not just these organisms, but it's similar to obligate sexual reproduction, three major ways, I think. It acts as a species homogenizing force, right, that presents a biological basis for classification. And if you know anything about prokaryotes, it's impossible to decide whether organisms belong to the same species or not. It's not impossible, but it's very, it's a practical assessment. It's difficult, but we can put a name on anything. It allows for the rapid fixation of individual advantageous traits. There's no periodic selection or clonal interference. And so it just seems to me that, you know, if we can have one allele at one locus that's been fixed in the population through recombination, we can certainly have another one somewhere on the chromosome that's doing exactly the same thing. And isn't this the advantage of sexual reproduction over asexual reproduction? And isn't that occurring in an asexual organism? Okay, and then three, for lineages to diverge, it would seem that some barriers to recombination have to be erected. Okay, so I kind of took away a little bit of my thunder here. Big question, you know, why does sexual reproduction exist if asexual reproducing organisms already benefit from the so-called advantages of sexual reproduction? Okay. I mean, this bugs me. It really bugs me.
But there's sort of population size effects here too, because the amount of it you need to do this in a large microbial population, you don't need to exchange DNA very often. While to do sort of similar things in a small population of microscopic organisms is rather different.
So you're saying that sex was invented in large organisms?
No.
With small population sizes.
But there's time scale issues, right? There's time scale issues, population size issues, which as to how much sex do you
need. So somewhere along the evolution of prokaryotes, I mean, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, because I've thought about this for a long time, and I mean, if you think about the evolution of sex, it must have happened originally in something that looked like a prokaryote, right? And which must have had a large population size and so on.
But a question of what you mean, I guess it's also a question of what you mean by sex. Do you mean exchange of
I mean, you know, obligate sexual reproduction. I mean, where did it come from? How, right? Anyway, I think it's a big question. Maybe you have it already figured out. I think a much smaller question then was that the asexual-sexual dichotomy seems to be broken, and then I'd really like to have a word that can be used to differentiate organisms that asexually reproduce but experience copious amounts of gene flow. Anyway, so back to the talk. Recombination, it cuts both ways in prokaryotic populations. It's a homogenizing force, but it's also a diversifying force that crosses species boundaries. It blurs lineages and destroys networks of shared ancestry. And so one of the things that we did, if you recall, and here's a reminder, very nice bootstrap for all of the relationships between those clusters. But that's from a concatenated tree. And so we decided to ask, is that a real assessment of how these organisms are actually related to each other? And so what we did was we basically apply a quartet kind of analysis, where we say this is group one, group two, group three, and the outgroup is group four. And we ask, how are those each of those clusters related to each other on an individual exhaustive? So we take one gene in one organism from this group and compare it to the same gene in the different organism. And so we build up all these quartets, and then we ask, you know, how often are those organisms related to each other? Right, and there are three different possibilities for a quartet. Right, you can have group B and group C related to each other. You can have group A and B related to each other, or you can have A and C related to each other. Right. So all we do is we ask exhaustively, you know, for each gene and for each for all of the organisms, which quartets do we get? And are they well supported? And so this characterizes or summarizes our analysis. And so here's the different topologies, color-coded for your pleasure. And then what it means to decipher this, if there's a value in any of these apices of the triangle, right, that's a highly supported result. A significant, highly supported result. If it occurs in one of these boxes along the sides of the triangle, this means that the analysis cannot distinguish between the two topologies, but it excludes the third topology. Okay? And then if it's in the middle, we can say that this is noise, that it can't distinguish between any of the three topologies with any significance.
You put your boxes a quarter and three quarters of the way along the edge of this triangle. That's just a convention.
I think so. Yeah. Okay. So here are the results for each of the genes. So the previous slide was actually the 16S, and so most of the time, topology 2, and just to remind you, topology 2 is A and B grouping together. And just to remind you one more time, here. B and C are actually the most closely related in the in the concatenated phylogeny. Okay, but remember, this is a significant result, and so is this. Okay, so in reality, both of these quartets, topology 2 and topology 1, are highly supported in this group of organisms. Okay, so the same gene actually gives two different highly supported topologies to consider. Okay, ATPB.
But then, if you just did a tree on 16S, it would.
I'll show you the 16S tree in a second.
It would support topology 2. Is that a reasonable approximation for what the bootstrap is that it would give on that node?
Probably, yeah.
And what do you mean when you say that this bootstrap is a really good one?
Well, generally we, so I only report here bootstrap values above 70%, but for instance, the relationship between B and C is, I think that's 94%. So I think that's pretty good. And the relationship between B and C and A, I think that says 97%. So it's pretty convincing. Okay. So back to ATPB, it's, its largest percentage is the topology 1, which is B and C, the expected outcome. But topology 3 groups A and B or A and C together. Okay, so again, we have a single gene, which when we do the full analysis, actually has high support for two different relationships within the same gene. Okay, and then the rhodopsin gene, which I think is really cool, supports topology 2, which again is A and B. And so if we think about this just for a second, here's A and here's B, right? And so we also know that from the previous analysis that there was some, I call it an adaptation that allowed it to go to fixation in the population. But in reality, it was probably a lateral gene transfer between species based on this analysis, if we accept the concatenated phylogeny as the evolutionary history of the groups.
So here you use these groups A, B, and C based on this concatenated topology, right? You define them by this concatenation.
Yeah.
What if you just define the groups by the sampling location?
So that, I mean, that's what this does. So you can define them according to color.
Right.
And so there's no support for any of the, right? No, no.
But if you did the coordinate analysis, would you get, higher numbers at the corners or not?
I'm glad you bring this up. So there is, and I don't have it, but I had pie charts. If you read through the PNAS paper, there are pie charts on location of where the alleles come from, and in general, probably the, if I remember correctly, the dominant allele is found in all of the in all of the sample sites, and then there. But most of the other alleles are partitioned into their individual sites. Okay, so I would say that the alleles demonstrate more of a biogeographic signature or a site-specific signature, but. One of the, if you remember, I said I wanted to come back to this, and I'm glad you reminded me. But so this was found in Spain, these organisms here, and maybe I think I've got another slide. But anyway, if you look at when you look at the individual genes, it turns out that even though these are found in Spain, two of their genes, I think, or two of their loci actually look like they come from Algeria. So there is some migration rate. We don't know what it is, but certainly it's left some sort of fossil in the Spanish Sauterne in terms of a gene rather than an organism, at least. So we know that the migration's occurring. So I don't think that this is as endemic to that site as we might think.
It's probably a gene, there's still a few differences in that gene, or
yep.
Identical.
Yeah, yeah. But phylogenetically, it groups.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, the question then becomes is the mutation rate, for instance, higher than the migration rate?
Yeah.
Right?
But if one looks at, you know, what one or two synonymous mutations in a gene corresponds to, that presumably, even assuming a pretty high mutation rate, that's a pretty long time ago.
Yeah, could be. We just don't have enough information. We really don't. I would remain agnostic about making any conclusions, because it could be that our ability to detect this through cultivation is highly biased. I mean, there's lots of reasons for thinking that we wouldn't find these organisms in Spanish. Even though, you know, if we went back and said and used PCR, are you there? I'm 100% convinced we'll find it in Spain. We just haven't been able to. We tried to develop primers for the rhodopsin genes, which seem to have the most, because even though they're identical within populations, they're the most divergent between the phylogroups. And so we were able to identify positions and tried to make primers for it, but it just never, we're just never able to get it to work. But evidence suggests that we could find these in Spain.
But within these groups, you can tell tell phenotypic differences in the lab, or they.
We haven't done that kind of analysis. I mean, we're trying to, right? Because my hypothesis would be, since these all live basically in the same microliter of water, you know. What's that?
Yeah, presumably real differences.
Presumably. That even, you know, you would have real differences in terms of phenotype within clusters. But, well, we had a major contamination, we don't have anything left. Yeah, so we're trying to do this with using 96 well phenotyping, and yeah, we're trying to, we've got some more samples and we're trying it again, but well.
The Spanish site's been in operation for centuries?
I don't know. In that location, probably, right? Because I mean, there are fossil salt turtles in the same region that aren't being used anymore, but yeah. Did you have your hand up earlier, or did we?
Oh, yeah, I was just going to ask if you had done environmental sequence surveys of these genes, and then you saw similar.
You know, and I'm not presenting. That's one of the things, I mean, I could sit here and talk all day. We have done, and I'm not sure what the question is that you're asking, but yes, we've
What's
done that.
What's the level of variation that you see when you don't have the cultivation bias?
Well, so these organisms themselves in the Spanish salt terns are subdominant, and so we don't really have a feeling for these particular organisms. The organism that dominates in this site is that square flat thing that I showed earlier on, and so, there's tons of recombination and tons of, you know, so it supports, but it's not direct evidence for these guys.
It's 9-to-1 ratio between recombination and mutation rate. Do you consider it high? Because you compared it to eukaryotes, but for, let's say, for E. coli, it was reported to be as high as 50. We are comparing apples to apples.
I know. And so,
for all the purposes,
yeah. I don't think that most people think that it's 50 to 1 for E. coli anymore.
Well, I would downplay it to 10 based on the genome data, so that puts it right in the ballpark.
And typically, these are the values. You know, there are some hyper recombinogenic things like Neisseria or Helicobacter pylori. They're maybe 100-to-1, roughly. These are values that come up quite frequently.
So it's not in any way anomalous in precarious.
I don't think so.
Such high ratio. Well, I mean,
yeah, yeah.
Such a ratio.
Yeah.
How big is the genome? What is it?
The main chromosome is about 3 for on average across the Haloarchaea, but they usually carry megaplasmids, which add them up to about 4. Right. So, So just to finish up this slide here, basically every single topology is found, and that this says to me that we really can't know the phylogenetic relationship. Now we can say, well, we have majority rules kind of thing, where okay, if we find topology one is the more dominantly found topology, but you know, does anybody know about thermatogas? I mean, these things, when Woz did the first tree, it branched very deeply in the bacterial lineage. And when they started doing genome sequencing, they saw that about 20% of the genes come from archaea. And now they've been doing even more and more sequencing. It turns out that about 75% of their genes come from Clostridia. About 10 or 15% come from archaea. And that only about 50 genes demonstrate a relationship with Aquifex, which is the presumed sister group to Thermatoga. So I don't know. I mean, we can impose a majority rules, but I would just be highly skeptical as to what that means.
Well, you showed us the cartoon of the Tree of Life. That's not a tree.
Yeah. So yeah. So one other thing. So that kind of polishes off part of the story. Recombination, I think. Because we see that there's, you know, we don't find any relationships between any of those four clusters, that it could be that recombination is acting as homogenizing force at higher levels of taxonomy, like genus or family or phyla, if the genes are more frequently transferred biased between different groups. So for instance, you know, you can say species 1, species 2, species 3, or genus 1, genus 2, genus 3. As long as there's more recombination flowing between those organisms than there is between other sets of organisms, you're going to get a biased understanding of what that means in terms of evolutionary history. Right, because it could be, for instance, that A2 and B3 really were sister organisms at some time, but because there's preferential gene flow, that you start to think, well, A, B, and 1, 2, 3 are actually more closely related to each other. Okay, so if we look for interphyla group recombination events, we see a handful, you know, not overwhelmingly, but for instance, so 116, and I can never see which one that is, but let's say it's this one. Anyway, well, it has to be in phyla group A, so it must be this one here. All right, so three of its genes look like canonical phyla group A genes, but its EF2 gene has 29 substitutions that are different at the nucleotide level. And so when you phylogenetically do this, it doesn't look like it belongs to any of these organisms. It looks like it's outside these groups. But it's not too different from what you would expect. So it's coming from somewhere in the Halorubrum genus, right? And the same with for instance, 82. So here you got three of its genes have this canonical A style, but then something, an unknown, recombined into it, and it has 63 nucleotide differences. Okay, that's about 20% divergent from the ones that we're thinking about being canonical A types. And so all of these highlighted in red explain, you know, so like this one, 67, I do believe, is one of these guys, yeah. Right, and so you can see that two of its genes come from C, but it was found in Spain. It has one from B, right, and something that clustered, for instance, here at the base of the B and C group. So there is interspecies recombination events, but it doesn't seem like they're really too crazy, you know, so it's still homogenizing, you know, these as a group. They're not like being transferred into, well, some bacterium, for instance. So it sort of supports this idea that there's a homogenization going on, even if it's between species, sort of destroying our ideas of what species are, but there's still some sort of homogenizing effect. Okay, so here's the 16S tree, and you can see there's almost no diversity, and most of the diversity comes from this group here. And I plotted the phylogroups in color, so here's the different phylogroups, and you can see that the different phylogroups have identical sequences, and even like phylogroup C has phylogroup X, and phylogroup X is one of the outgroups, and so on and so forth. So it seems to me, this analysis, that we can conclude that the 16S gene, which is typically our species marker, is the most frequently recombined gene between these three different so-called species. Okay, so if you just use the 16S gene and using standard species definitions, so here again is the three. So this is the, if you were to use the 16S gene, you would have to put them, all of these organisms, into the same species, okay? Because there's only about 1% divergence. And then doing some other, I don't know how familiar everybody is, but there's been some other proposed cutoff values for how we can define species. And one of these is the average nucleotide index. And so if you use 99%, we get something that's very similar to the clusters that we've identified, just, you know, by me saying, oh, that's a cluster. Okay, so we get something close, but then it excludes things that have obviously undergone some recombination, for instance. And then if you use the recommended ANI value of 96%, then again, they're all in the same species again. And I would definitely say that they're not the same species, because we know that there are barriers to recombination in the sense that recombination is more frequent within these groups, right? Because they're in equilibrium, but they're not in equilibrium when you compare them in pairwise comparisons.
So if you sequence four more loci, concatenated them, yeah. Do you expect this to change significantly as well?
I don't know what my expectations are. I mean, I guess that probably we would. I mean, the neat thing is that when you can concatenate them, you get this beautiful. But in the individual trees, this is not so apparent. It's much, much more messy.
It's hard to tear apart when I'm watching.
Well, that's what these are trying to do here.
They're trying, right. So. And can you remind me, why did Woese choose 16S? It's very ancient.
Yeah, so it's found in all of the it's found in all organisms. He started off with 5S originally, but it's just too small and didn't really give enough information across. So the 16S is a bit of a compromise. Yeah, there's a 23S as well, and or the large subunit, which is much, much larger, of course. And so it was sort of an intermediate in size, and back when sequencing was much more problematic.
I just, so someone who knows more about them from an RNA, maybe can answer this, but my sense was that the RNAs were extremely sensitive to various positive ions. And so maybe big, very big selection pressure in these extremely isolated environments for having the right, you know, slightly better.
Actually, it doesn't work out that way. There are some halo archaea that have, actually, so there's lots of halo archaea with multiple divergent operons, and it turns out that temperature is what upregulates divergent operons, not salt.
But is, if one takes a, well,
I mean, it seems like the obvious, but, I mean,
well, but that's
salt.
The question, but whether those are already well adjusted to the salt. I mean, it's,
well, these are the same. It's the same organism that has divergent operons, and so you know, you could assume that, well, if it finds itself in a lower salinity, which they probably do because it rains, and so one might be more highly tuned to be in a different salinity than another, then it would upregulate.
Have
one,
these have several operons?
Well, so we don't know. It look, some relatives that have been examined, they have more than one operon. The 16S is identical between copies, but the 23S is not. So.
On your previous slide, I think just one up, or maybe one more. You can see that the distribution of SNPs when you align those concatenated things is extremely homogeneous, right? You have something in group A and group A, and then which presumably have within two substitutions within a group, or you know, one or two substitutions per allele, and then suddenly you have 29, or A, then 63, and then.
Yeah.
So wouldn't it make sense if you want to reconstruct some clonal history to get rid of those outliers, like much like when you do correlation analysis, you throw away the.
Yeah, I think that lots of people do that.
But would it change your conclusions? Because it looks like
I would remove all the recombination that I'm staking my life on.
In the recombined regions and the clonal regions, you can get a very.
So I mean, most of the recombination that I'm talking about occurs here within, rather than between.
Okay.
So this is really between, although it's not necessarily between these two guys. It could be something out in the population out here that's inserting itself into there. And so all I'm saying here is that that sort of event is causing a homogenization at the genus level, right? It's you know, preventing, you know, so when recombination is happening, it's not one of these things that's all of a sudden sending it out into another genus, for instance. Right, it's acting as a homogenizing force genus identification. I mean, the really good thing that we're good at doing is saying, oh yes, this is E. coli, but what is acting as the homogenizing force for E. coli? Well, I don't know, but for these guys, it seems to be recombination. Or?
So I guess I'm trying to understand a little better what we're being told. So there is equilibration within the subgroups.
Well, yeah.
And we're out of equilibrium, so there is some.
Between the groups. But it doesn't mean that there's an absence of recombination.
Right. It doesn't mean that there's absence of recombination, but so now let's accept that there is recombination and try to understand how we can be in equilibrium and out of equilibrium, right? And one way of understanding it would be to say that. Well, again, what's important is the rate of recombination to some characteristic strength of selection, which is amplifying clones there within the different population. Right? And so one obvious thing to say would be that because they live, one in Spain, another one in Algeria, they just get to recombine less, not because they can't, but because they don't get the chance. Right? Alternatively, we can say that there actually is some interaction between your different genes, that one flavor of rhodopsin, which is actually quite distinct from in different clones, right?
In the different phyla groups, they're very distinct, but within the phyla groups. But this isn't upon.
We're talking between now.
Right, but but you can see here that these organisms live in all the ponds, so that it's not a pond.
It's still a matter of frequency. If the frequency of one thing is,
I don't disagree that it's a frequency thing.
So I guess I'm trying to think if we can distinguish between two scenarios.
Sure.
One is epistasis. The other one is a structured population, where recombination is occurring mostly in subpopulations, right? And I'm just wondering if you've given us a clue here by saying that 16S actually is in equilibrium.
So you mean, yeah, so you, between the Between the phylogroups, yes. I would say that there that it looks like there's some sort of equilibrium there. But I would say the reason why we see recombination between the phylogroups at this locus as opposed to the other loci, at least on a frequency, right? Because here I'm saying, you know, it just happens like maybe 8 times. Right, this is the only data I really have out those 5 loci examined. I have 8 examples in which there's a transfer between genera. So they seem fairly resistant to it, right? And certainly the index of association says that within the phylogroups there's the recombination rate is sufficient to randomize the alleles. Now, what I think is happening here, and I don't know, I don't think it's an epistasis, I think what it is that the 16S gene is just too conserved. I mean, it's highly conserved. If you get a mutation in the 16S, it's likely to be deleterious and you're going to die immediately, right? Because you can't make proteins. And so because it's so conserved, right, the barrier to recombination is not necessarily that there's something intrinsic about the organisms themselves, but that the more divergent two sequences are to each other, the less likely they are to recombine. But the more similar they are, the more likely they are to recombine. Right? And so there doesn't appear to be, at least at the 16S level, there doesn't appear to be something that's intrinsic about the DNA that they can acquire. So you can think of this as like being a post-mating event, right? So as opposed to a pre-mating event that's going to prevent 16S genes from being introduced into the cell. I guess that's how I sort of think about it, and that there's nothing really that prevents the pre-mating of DNA from coming in, but because they're so highly conserved between the different phylogroups, right, that the recombination is just more frequent, is going to happen more frequently. I'll show you a slide on that in a second.
Genes are very close.
What's that?
But aren't even more diverged genes still very close together between the genera?
Well, I mean, they're about a minimum of 3% divergent, right?
This divergence is in silent mutations in these genes.
And it's so, in silent mutations.
And there are no silent mutations for 16S because it encodes RNA, not protein.
No, I understand. I mean, but it could be that it's silent in the sense that it could happen in a loop structure where the RNA is not interacting as tightly with the protein in that particular position. So I mean there could be less and more deleterious mutation.
If you compare the non-synonymous differences between the genes, how does that compare with the differences in the 16S?
You mean but that's not going to have an effect on homologous recombination, right?
No, I'm just asking for how different they are. I mean, you're making the argument.
Right. I mean, there are not a lot of amino acid substitutions between phylogroups.
So those are sort of it's sort of comparable ballpark differences.
I can't remember the exact. I mean, I could, you know, just from, you know, my mental image of the alignments, there really are not a lot of amino acid changes between the phylogroups.
Is this data accessible somewhere, so can one just...
Oh yeah, it's all in NCBI. I can send you the alignments if you like them.
Just, you know, going back to this question of, for example, frequency of spectrum of polymorphisms.
Sure.
Within your...
I would be happy to give you my alignments.
I guess maybe, as I understand Boris's question, maybe to generalize it, are there any genes for which there's no disequilibrium between populations, which would suggest that then there is migration?
You know, I don't think that is a question that I asked, but if it were to happen, I would say it looks like the 16S would be the case.
Except that there's so little variation in 16S that
you're not
going to
tell. Exactly.
I mean, what Boris is asking is there any evidence for recombination between groups? And then at any locus, in which case, if at some loci there's strong disequilibrium, then that argues for the epistasis interpretation. Whereas if you looked across, say, the whole genome and you recovered the same disequilibrium between groups, then you would be more inclined to suppose they just don't see each other and they don't go to the same bars until they don't have sex.
Well, I don't think that would be true. I think they do go to the same bar, but something. I mean, here's the second big question. They're all highly recombinogenic. At some point, they had a common ancestor, right? In which was by, you know, assumption, must have been highly recombinogenic. So what was it here that happened that allowed these divergences to occur in here to there, right? And so some barrier, right? Now we're thinking about geographic isolation or some sort of ecological condition in which they're not seeing each other anymore. But I mean, something had to have happened. What it was,
I mean, the barrier could be epistasis, or the barrier could be geographic separation. I mean, I agree with what you said, but I don't think that distinguishes between.
But anybody, I mean, you're free to, if you've got ideas, you're more than welcome to look at this data. And if you want to help me sequence genomes, I'm into that as well. Okay, so we've taken multi-locus sequence analysis and we've looked at lots of different genera and species in the Haloarchaea, and it really looks as if this so this is a multi-locus, and we've done splits tree analysis. We didn't force everything into being a bifurcating tree. And if you haven't seen these things before, well, they're just damn difficult to understand. But in general, the more net-like, you know, you could imagine this is a bifurcating tree, and that any single one of these lines is a way to understand the evolution of any relationship between any two particular organisms.
Are we seeing horizontal transfer somehow?
Yeah, so that's what, you know, so this is the fogginess of the evolutionary relationships among these organisms here, right, that is probably undisputably, in my opinion, caused by lateral gene transfer. But if so this is a lot of Haloarchaea. These are the Halorubrums that we've been looking at. And you can see that there's a lot of recombination going on within the group, and that there's just, it looks somewhat non-recombinogenic between the Halorubrum and other groups. And then the only other group that we have a lot of data on is Haloarchaeas. And again, this is here, I blow it up, and you can see that there is a lot more recombination going on within the Haloarchaea than there is between the Haloarchaea and other groups.
And these groups live together, do they?
Presumably. I mean, these are, you know, this is from the culture collection that people have been accumulating over the years. I mean, only Haloarchaea, well, that's not exactly true. Mostly 90%, 99% of the organisms that live in these, in these environments are Haloarchaea. So, but what we don't know in general is how are each of the individual places composed, right? Okay.
So can we see the phylo groups in the lower left?
Yeah. I mean, you know, here's one, and here's two, and here's three.
And so the edges, you can, because I've never gotten my head around how to read these things either, but you're saying we can think of them as the union of the trees that you get if you went gene by gene?
Yeah, essentially.
Or nucleotide by nucleotide, maybe?
Yeah. So I mean, if you think about this, I mean, if you look constructed a phylogeny of all of our genes in this room, right, this is what it would look like, right? I mean, we don't have a phylogeny of individuals in populations. And I mean, that's, you know.
Unless it's mitochondrial or microbial.
Well, yeah, if there is an asexual component to it, right? But if it looks like this, then the answer is no, that's not an asexual lineage. And so we have to be thinking about prokaryotes, I think. I mean, I can't think, there maybe Bucknera, which has been living clonally inside of aphids for 100 million years, is probably about the only prokaryote you're going to find that you're not going to see, you know, I've seen where they've taken like 50 genes, and some people say, okay, here's the tree of life, and somebody else does the same analysis using a splits tree, and it's a big circle because there's so much connection between every single. It's not a tree. There's no tree. It's a population of. Anyway. You want to take a break? I got some really cool stuff on mechanisms of lateral gene transfer.
Push on until 12, is that?
All right, no interruptions then. Okay. Well. Okay, so these are known mechanisms for lateral gene transfer in archaea, or in haloarchaea, and here's the canonical phage, and a lot of work has been done by Mike Dial-Smith on this. And then unknown probably to most people in the universe, even in our universe, is that haloarchaea and maybe some other organisms, they can do a form of conjugation that's non-canonical. It's not a pilus-driven, plasmid-driven sort of conjugation system. In fact, this is a cell fusion event, okay? And if you freeze fracture, I can't find the only copy of this paper that I have is from a photocopy, because this is from the 1970s before this journal is not online and so on and so forth. But they did some really nice freeze fracturing of these cells, and you can see that the membranes are contiguous between these, and you can see that the S layer is contiguous, right? And that this is some sort of an initial fusion of the cells. And the genetic system also tells us that, well, if you make auxotrophic mutants of different strains, and if you get three of them, and you make these in pairwise matings, that there is no donor and no recipient, right? That this is it's a cell fusion, and the DNA inside is mixed together, and it's recombining, and then there's some sort of mechanism for getting it to separate. And so this is the model that's been proposed. And again, you could this was discovered in the mid 80s, and really nobody's done any work on that since. And that basically Moshe Mavark from Tel Aviv was basically the only guy working on this. He discovered it, and he wrote four or five papers on it. I don't know if he got bored with it, or nobody believed him, or what. But clearly, from the genetic evidence and from the microscopy evidence, it suggests that these are some sort of initialization of fusion. We know that the DNA is not being passed between in these things, right? So what happens is the cells fuse. Nobody's documented this. This is based on evidence from models, from experimental models. Nobody's seen this in a photograph, okay? but the experimental data say that this is the case. And so you get DNA moving back and forth, you get plasmids moving back and forth, and recombination is occurring, and you get differential plasmid keeping. Okay? And so this has been, it's been 20 years, and really nobody's moved forward on this at all.
But the chromosome stays intact, too.
Yeah, the chromosome stays intact. Also, somebody said, I can't remember, there's about, we know that that each of these guys has about 30 copies of its genome. And this is, even in stationary phase, it maintains a high copy. Somebody said they overproduce, I don't know. Maybe it's the expectation. It turns out that probably E. coli is the only organisms that...
It's not because of the mutation rates being so high that it needs that to have.
I don't know that the mutation rate's so high.
Are they? I don't know.
I don't think. I think it's.
No.
Well, I don't, I mean, they have three mud S's, and they have, well, they're resistant to UV and radiation and standard, I don't know. They probably just have a standard mutation rate, whatever that means. So we're interested, right? Because maybe this helps us to explain why there might be some sort of bias in the lateral, you know, in the recombination that we see in the natural populations. Because maybe there's a way that they're recognizing each other, and this, they're not going to do this between species, for instance, right? So we tried this, and we mated two species, Halopharynx mediterranei and Halopharynx volcanii. Both the genomes for these organisms are known, and we had to do this using molecular markers for the, you know, the auxotrophic markers that we had, so we could select out for these particular organisms. And so we got lots of recombinants, because we selected for them and we know that they're recombinants, and we did PCR on several of them, and we know that, for instance, we get recombination events in the same region, but not exactly at the same places, right? And the reason why it's in the same region again is because that's where our auxotrophic.
They just mix together in a lab, and then you're selecting on ones that show both markers.
Right. Okay. And so we did sequence the genome of one of our offspring. We call it the Halopharynx vesuvii because it's a Mediterranean volcano. and so you can, so if you compare the Mediterranean versus the hybrid genome, it's identical until you get to this part where you get all of this, and then the opposite, of course. If you look at the volcanii genome and compare it to the hybrid genome, it's quite noisy, and then it's identical and quite noisy. So, and these organisms are about 13% divergent across, on average, on their genome. So
are the genes ordered similarly?
Similarly, yeah. Yeah. There's some synteny. There is synteny.
And this, of course, now here you have replacements in coding regions as well.
Yeah. So it's about 300, I can't remember if it's 300 or 400 KB.
Right.
But it's a significant portion.
Replaced, right? So it's not only a cell replacement.
Yeah, it's a complete replacement. The whole thing. I mean, it's, right, so it's 100% identical to the volcanii genome and 100% identical to the Mediterranean genome, right? So, I mean, we have the genomes for these things, and so this is a very large fraction. Now, there's a lot of spots up here where you see they're identical, but we've gone through, this is our original analysis, and those are places where there's a lot of ends in the sequence data. We thought we had a recombination event in one of the plasmids. We got very excited, but that didn't turn out.
And do these have multiple chromosomes in the cell also? Do they?
Yeah.
And do you know? So you, but you don't. Do you know if all of the chromosomes?
You know,
same, or you have mixtures of them.
So initially, there's mixtures, right? Because I didn't put that slide in. But when we do the PCR after we do the mating, they maintain both copies of both chromosomes in the genomes of the cells, right? And it's only after we apply the selective pressure that they have to decide between things. And we force them, you know, only the recombinants are going to come out, right?
But the multi-copies, the recombinant, if it had three Mediterraneans, three volcani, and one recombinant, that presumably makes it through the selection.
Presumably.
But you know if they have multiple?
Well, I mean, this is the offspring. We sequenced the genome, and it only keeps.
Oh, so it doesn't show the other of it at all. It's not.
Yeah,
really
nothing else is kept. Only the, you know. But before we apply the selection event, you know, we go in and we look, and we can we find all of the alleles that we're, you know, that we're looking for. Right? They have both copies from both genomes, so. they mated, they've got both genomes, they hold those both genomes for a generation or two at the most, and then the selection event forces them to choose.
But you could imagine a diploid could survive the selection event.
It doesn't. It can't. Yeah, I can't remember why. Sorry.
But you'd know if you're...
Is that just because these chromosomes, they when the cells divide, they segregate sort of somewhat randomly?
I think so.
And so the diploid would exponentially grow much less, yeah, because it's unlikely they would... Yeah.
The selection isn't, because there's still many...
Unless there's no recombination and you need them heterozygous advantage.
So you...
Right. I mean, if they're supposed... Right. Sorry, I'm totally derailing you.
It's
not my suggestion.
I have 10 minutes.
But if there were no recombination, the only ones that would survive would be that.
Right, and
but also, if there's not full synteny, so you're missing some crucial genes, which is having one of them.
But if you have the, yeah, if you do have a recombinant, it'll grow much faster.
I want to put the kibosh, because I got something really cool to show you. All right, so one of my students, he said, well, I don't believe there's no natural competence. That's just ridiculous. People have been, this is a model organism for many years, and people have been doing PEG-mediated transformation of these things, and nobody's ever shown any transformation. And they said, well, okay, just show me that they can eat DNA as a sole carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus source. And so he did. And this is what he did was we starved them on no media just to make sure that all of any and all carbon sources were utilized for 24 hours. And like I said, they don't really die, so it kind of works out okay. And so here at 24 hours, he puts DNA into one of his samples. This is the no nutrient control, and it takes off, and it has a very nice p-value. And it turns out that this is concentration dependent. If you add 200 micrograms per milliliter, you get twice as much growth. Okay, so they can grow on DNA. The question is, are they taking DNA up into the cells, or are they hydrolyzing DNA outside the cell? And so we're pretty sure that they are in fact bringing DNA into the cell, because if we put DNA into, say, fresh LB media, and then, or add DNase to it, right? Or we take, so Staphylococcus aureus, which is known to secrete DNase into the media. If you put DNA into conditioned media, then the DNA gets chopped up. And then if we do the same experiment in the Halopharynx, well, we don't get any sort of, So there's no excreted DNases into the medium. And so they're definitely taking up DNA. And a really cool thing comes, we're using our own DNA from our own organisms, and my student said, or Scott said, I'm really tired, this takes a lot of work, and purifying DNA, blah, blah, blah. Do you mind if I buy some herring sperm from Sigma? And I said, no, sure, go ahead. So he gets the herring sperm, he brings it, and he starts to do the experiments, and he couldn't get any growth on his organisms. And well, I was really excited about this, because that would mean that there's some sort of selective uptake. And we went through all these processes of repurifying the DNA and from the herring sperm, and consistently got these results. And I said, okay, well, nobody's gonna believe us. Do E. coli. So he did E. coli, and he got no growth again. And we tried other organisms, different genera, and we get lots of growth on. So they appear to be able to eat their own DNA. They appear to be able to eat other haloarchaeal DNA, but they won't eat bacterial DNA, and they won't eat herring sperm DNA.
Is there 30 chromosomes, and they can eat 29 of them and keep one?
So what's the GC composition of the E. coli and the herring sperm relative to the
halo group? Much, much different. Oh, good.
Right, so if you have another organism that has a similar GC content to the halo group, what do you see then?
Good question. The answer is Micrococcus luteus, 74% GC, no growth. They don't grow on nucleotides, which confirms our initial observation that they don't secrete a DNase. But if we have an E. coli mutant that cannot methylate its DNA, we get the best growth of them all. So it turns out that it discriminates the DNA based on some sort of methylation pattern. We don't know what that pattern is. We don't know how conserved it is between different groups. We do know that Haloarchaea methylate their DNA because, well, it's in the literature. There's only one other known form of DNA discrimination. I'll talk about that. Well, I'm running out of time, but there are nucleotides. So Neisseria, for instance, has to have a 10-mer in its genes, in its DNA, to be recognized by the DNA uptake machinery in order to be imported. And so this is a second mechanism, the only other known mechanism for DNA discrimination. So it turns out, getting back to a question earlier, there's quite a lot of genes involved in DNA uptake. This is a gram-positive scenario. This is a gram-negative scenario. This is type 4 pilus. There's a lot of homology in terms of parts between the different systems and so on and so forth. We do some bioinformatics. It turns out that the Haloarchaea have competence genes, that are similar, seem much more similar to the gram-positive system than they are the gram-negative system, which makes a sense in a rudimentary way because there's no periplasm. And then getting back, the transformation frequency is much more, this is sexual isolation, so it's the opposite of the way we're usually thinking about it, but this is sequence divergence, and the more diverged you are, the more sexually isolated you are. Right. But as I was just saying, there are ways of only acquiring DNA. So think of it as a pre-mating sort of scenario where you have to have these repeated sequences in order to be brought into the genome. So you're not necessarily going to bring it. Now, of course, this could happen randomly, and you could acquire genes from another species by random, something that has these sequences. But, they occur 1,500 times, 2,000 times on a genome.
How does Helicobacter do it? Different mechanism.
It's a different mechanism. So just to quickly talk about quorum sensing, and maybe it's pre-talk to Bonnie Bassler, will be talking about quorum sensing a bit. But there's two basic models. There's the gram-negative system and the gram-positive system. The gram-negatives, they generate these homoserine lactones, which freely diffuse across the cell membranes. And when the concentration gets high, they upregulate genes. In the gram-positive system, they have a protein that gets exported into the milieu, and it's recognized by a protein which then phosphorylates and upregulates things. And
the receiver cell then retransmit?
No. I mean, it's producing its own peptide, right? And so obviously the concentration, again, so once it hits the receiving protein, it turns, cascades, and then things get upregulated, so it produces more of the protein, et cetera. So it turns out that for instance, in Streptococcus, competence is regulated by quorum sensing, okay? And so only when cells get up to a certain density in the population are they going to turn on their genes for acquiring DNA outside the cell, right? And so they're hedging their bets in a sense. It's not a flawless way of doing it, but you can imagine that if you have more of your compatriots around you, you're only going to get your own DNA. So this could be another mechanism for how you can maintain a specificity. So it's a sort of a pre-mating barrier to exchange. And it turns out that the Haloarchaea, all Haloarchaea, have these two homologs, and we think we have this called the pre-competent stimulating protein that's right next to one of these two genes. I can't remember now, but you know, we have it by some sort of homology. It's very short, and it's not really, I say homology, but well, I guess you can use homology. That's not sequence homology. Right, and then the really cool thing about some of this is that competent cells do not rely on the arbitrary death of another cell. They can actually use competence as a way to kill non-competent cells in their population, right? And so usually these things are growing, right? So, again, almost no organisms grow in well-mixed in planktonic communities. So the gradients, so they all have the genes, but not everybody is turning on competence at the same time. And so those in the population that are competent are killing and lysing the ones that are not competent. And then perhaps even more cool is that some competent cells can induce other cells in the population to secrete DNA. So rather than killing your compatriots, you're forcing them to feed you, okay? And so it turns out that the bioinformatic analysis for the Haloarchaea show that there's a type 4 secretion system, and so we knocked out part of it. Actually, we've knocked out all of these genes now, but I can't tell you about it anymore, or tell you about it right yet, except for to say that with a collaborator, Mekki Polschroeder, she gave us a gene that knocks out pilins, so there's no pilin production at all, and we get no DNA growth. We get no growth on DNA, so we know that it seems to be a canonical natural competent system that requires pilins. Anyway, I'm going to stop right there. It's 12 o'clock. I want to talk about biogeography, but just say that it's important. And here are my acknowledgments. Thanks.